I know, I need a little chair, maybe an overhead. Guess it's a happy day today. The Lakers begin their defense of the title, right? So, got that going on. Let's just start. We're going to be going through the end of chapter 3 of James today, James 3, 13 through 18. If you have your printout, on the back side is the passage, so you can either turn in your Bible to that, or just turn your handout over. I'd just like to start by reading through and hearing the word of the Lord together, and then we'll dive right into the message. So. James 3:13 says, "If you are wise in understanding God and understand God's ways, prove it by living an honorable life, doing good works with the humility that comes from wisdom. But if you are bitterly jealous and there is selfish ambition in your heart, don't cover up the truth with boasting and lying, for jealousy and selfishness are not God's kind of wisdom. Such things are earthly, unspiritual, demonic. For wherever there is jealousy and selfish ambition, there you will find disorder and evil of every kind. But the wisdom from above is first of all pure. It is also peace-loving, gentle at all times, and willing to yield to others. It is full of mercy and good deeds. It shows no favoritism and is always sincere. And those who are peacemakers will plant seeds of peace and reap a harvest of righteousness." As you can see, today's passage is about the concept of wisdom. And we had kind of booked this several weeks in advance for me to be up here speaking, and I hadn't looked at the passage. And then when I looked at the passage and saw that I would be speaking about wisdom, I just sort of chuckled a little bit, because to me it seemed like a really ironic thing that I would be here on a Tuesday morning standing up in front of you and talking to you guys about wisdom. Because most weeks, the reason I come to the men's Bible study is actually to come and sort of soak up the lessons of life from people who are wiser than me. And so I'd come, I sit at the tables. I usually don't talk a whole lot. I just try to listen to what you guys have to say and then absorb those lessons. So I don't know, always when you're teaching, there's a little bit of uncomfortableness of telling people how to live and that sort of thing. But especially when you come to the topic of wisdom, I just feel totally unqualified in some ways to talk about this. I'm 26 years old, still can't grow a beard. I don't really have enough gray hair to be up here right now, or I have too much hair, one of the two. So I just feel like I need to give that disclaimer right at the beginning. I'm young. I've studied this passage. I really feel like there's a lot here for us to learn from. So hopefully we can learn together. But that's a disclaimer right at the beginning that I don't have all this figured out, and I'm just working through it. And hopefully as we get into the discussion times, we can talk through some of these things and learn together. So that's just a disclaimer. Some of my insecurities, getting those out there at the beginning. You know, when you feel ill, I'm the type of person, I'm usually a pretty healthy person. I don't feel sick very often, but every once in a while, something in my body will just feel a little bit off. And I'm the type of person who immediately gets paranoid and tries to figure out what's going on. You know, if I have a cough or I'm just feeling a little lethargic or whatever, I just immediately kind of panic, like, uh-oh, this could be something serious. And I always jump to the, like, worst conclusion of what it might be. And so I rush online. This is kind of my way of doing things, is rather than going to somebody who knows what they're doing and knows what they're talking about, I just rush online and I type in whatever I'm feeling. And then I look at, you know, like WebMD, something pops up, there are all sorts of conditions. And I just start clicking through those and seeing, okay, here's a list of symptoms, you know, some sort of diagnostic kind of a checklist that I can look over and try to match up what I'm feeling to this list of symptoms. It'll tell you, like, what's the source of this condition that they're describing, and then what ultimately will happen if you just leave it untreated, or what you need to do to take care of it. So that's kind of my way of doing things whenever I'm feeling a little bit ill, you know. Or if you go into the doctor does basically the same thing. You go into a checkup and you sit on that table with the paper on it, and you know, they take your vital signs, and then the doctor comes in, and he'll ask you to describe how you're feeling. He's just kind of listening, taking notes, and then he'll shine that light in your eyes and in your ears. I ask you to take a couple deep breaths and everything, and then he says, "Okay, I'll be back in a minute," and he just walks out, and you're left to sit alone on that table, just doing nothing for like 5 or 10 minutes. And you know, I always kind of wondered, why does that happen? But what they're doing, of course, is they're going off and checking some sort of diagnostic manual, some book where they can look up, see what you've got going on, match up those symptoms to this book, and this diagnostic manual tell them, you know, what's the source of what's going on, where does it come from, what does this condition look like, and then ultimately, what do they need to do? What's the prognosis if we just leave it untreated, or what can we do to kind of make things better? And the reason I talk about all that is, as we turn to this passage here in James, it's sort of like a diagnostic manual or a symptoms checklist for two different types of wisdom. James first describes this concept of a false wisdom that comes from an evil source. It manifests itself in certain ways, and if we just leave it to run its course, it's going to end up in all sorts of negative outcomes. And then if you turn and you look after that kind of wisdom to the last couple of verses in the passage, he describes a true wisdom. It's a wisdom that comes from God, manifests itself in seven different symptoms that James describes, and its ultimate outcome is very positive. And so that's what we've got here in this passage. So what I'd like to do today is just kind of walk through it, check this checklist, and what we can do is kind of look at ourselves, look at this list, see, kind of give ourselves a self-checkup, you know, and figure out maybe areas where we have some of this in our lives, and maybe if there's any changes, adjustments that we need to make, we can do that. And we'll end up with some application points as well. Just at the outset, as we start talking about this, there's another qualification that I need to make, and that is that as James talks about the concept of wisdom, he does it in a very practical, functional way. Whenever you're defining any given concept, you can do it in two ways. You can talk about what a thing is, or you can talk about what a thing does. What it looks like. If you're talking about what a thing is, that's a theoretical definition, and you're talking about the essence of whatever the concept or the thing is. But if you're talking about what a thing does, you're giving a very practical, functional, concrete definition to it. So, just for example, if I ask you the question, what is a diamond? You could answer that in a couple of ways. Theoretically, a technical answer would be, a diamond is an extremely hard, highly refractive, crystalline form of tetrahedrally bonded carbon atoms. Okay, so if a kid came up to you and asked you what is a diamond, you could give an accurate definition of a diamond, and this would be it. But we all know that realistically, if all you know is a theoretical definition of a diamond, you don't really know what a diamond is. Much easier way to define a diamond, if someone asks you what is a diamond, would be to take a ring, let them hold it up to the light, and say, here is what a diamond looks like. This is a diamond. Look at it, see how light refracts off it. That's the way we define a diamond. Certain things are better defined by what they do or what they look like than by what they are in their essence. Same thing with something like gasoline. What is gasoline? Well, it's pretty simple. It's a highly volatile mixture of fluid hydrocarbons obtained from petroleum, as also by the distillation of bituminous coal. There's the theoretical definition. Well, if someone asks you what is gasoline, it'd be much easier just to say gasoline is what we put in our car to go from point A to point B. Gasoline is what makes a car go. It's another one of those concepts that's better defined by what it does, or at least it's more helpful to define by what it does than by what it is. So when we turn to the Bible and we ask, what is wisdom? Well, theoretical definition, if we look at the whole biblical picture and we try to kind of synthesize what wisdom might be, we could come up with this theoretical definition. This is from a Bible dictionary. And it, you know, you would round this out with some other statements, but in its essence, wisdom is the art of being successful, of forming the correct plan to gain the desired results. You see, so there's a theoretical definition, but when James wants to talk about wisdom, and really in the Bible for the most part, like in the book of Proverbs, when biblical authors want to talk about the concept of wisdom, they mostly speak about it in very practical terms, because wisdom is one of those things, kind of like a diamond or gasoline. It's better described by what it looks like and what it does than maybe necessarily what it is in its essence. So James defines wisdom practically rather than theoretically. For him, it's an active relational concept. And the reason I'm making this observation, there's a couple of reasons. First of all, as we hop into the passage and James starts describing wisdom and he's using all of these moral categories and kind of talking about these different virtues that define wisdom, it can get a little confusing if we just equate wisdom with morality. And wisdom sort of loses its definition because all of a sudden it's wisdom is purity, wisdom is gentleness, wisdom is all of these just moral qualities. It's important to remember, well, that's what wisdom does, but there's this essential definition of wisdom that can be distinguished. The second reason I bring this up and I mention it is just because some of those kind of images we have in our head of wisdom in our culture tend to be very much at the theoretical, abstract level. Or at least for me, that's where I tend to think of the concept of wisdom. It's mostly in the realm of the intellect. It's a mental thing. You know, if you ask me what I think of when I think of wisdom, I tend to have the image in my mind of an old man who's up on a mountain somewhere, sitting alone by himself, thinking deep thoughts, you know. If you ask me what is wisdom, I think of a wizard, someone like Gandalf from Lord of the Rings, maybe Yoda from Star Wars, this guy who lives alone, is by himself, and he's just spending all his time thinking and speaks in proverbs, you know. But actually, for James, wisdom's not this lonely concept. It's a very active, relational, engaging concept. It's not just about what you know. It's about how you live based upon what you know. And you see that right at the outset of this passage. You look at the first verse. This is kind of a summary statement, big picture, what James wants to describe here in this passage. Look at verse 13. He says, "If you are wise and understand God's ways, prove it by living an honorable life, doing good works with the humility that comes from wisdom." For James, the test of wisdom is life. And notice there's a couple things. Where James says wisdom is going to show itself in two areas of life. First, in our actions by doing good works, but then also, secondly, with the attitude that we bring to those actions, with the humility that comes from wisdom. So, test of wisdom is life, and the wise person is going to show his wisdom by the life that he lives. It's going to be characterized by good deeds, and more than that, as he's doing those good deeds, those are going to be done through an attitude of humility. Okay, so as I said, we've got this symptoms checklist for wisdom, and James, in this passage, most of what he's doing is comparing two different types of wisdom. There's that false wisdom, and then there's that true wisdom. And the way I want to go about this and work through the passage is just look at three questions that James basically addresses as he describes each of these types of wisdom. First, he talks about what each type of wisdom looks like, using the medical analogy, what the symptoms of that wisdom are. Next, he talks about where does it come from, what's its source, its origin. And then finally, he talks about what is its ultimate result. If we just leave it to run its course, what is gonna happen? So those are the three questions that we're going to kind of look at as we work through this passage. So let's look at first at this concept of false wisdom. That's verses 14 through 16. So you can read with me. "But if you are bitterly jealous and there is selfish ambition in your heart, don't cover up the truth with boasting and lying. For jealousy and selfishness are not God's kind of wisdom. Such things are earthly, unspiritual, and demonic." For wherever there is jealousy and selfish ambition, there you will find disorder and every evil kind. And evil of every kind. Sorry about that. Okay, so first, what does it look like? As we look at the top of verse 14, there are two qualities that James describes of this wisdom. First is that it's bitterly jealous, and then second, there is selfish ambition in your heart. So what does it look like? Bitter jealousy and selfish ambition. That concept of bitter jealousy, that has to do with how you view the successes of others. I think if you get at its core, where does bitter jealousy expose itself? It's when other people do well, or they receive praise, or they gain popularity, and you're left to respond to that. Can you respond in genuine happiness for how these people may feel, or for what they've accomplished? Or are you bitterly jealous? Do you look at it and think, that should have been me? I should be the one receiving this praise. I should be the one getting this promotion. Bitter jealousy has to do with how we respond to the successes of others. Do we respond with a genuine feeling of gladness, or a feeling of negativity and comparison competitiveness? Selfish ambition has to do with our motives and how we make decisions, or the criteria by which we make decisions, I guess you could say. Selfish ambition, when we're making decisions based off selfish ambition, would have to do with, like, I'm only making decisions with reference to how this decision is going to affect me. Is this going to get me more money? Is this going to get me more prestige, more honor, more glory? Is it going to be good for my immediate benefit? That's the concept of selfish ambition. And James says that this first type of wisdom is defined by these two qualities. I think it's interesting when you put it this way. We all probably fight against some level of bitter jealousy or selfish ambition in our own lives. But at the same time, we look at them both of these concepts, and they, those sound like negative terms. Selfishness is something we frown upon in society, and jealousy is something that we also, especially bitter jealousy, is something that we also look at and we think, well, that's not a great thing. But actually, I think that we oftentimes rename these qualities and then praise them as virtues in certain arenas. And I I'm a huge sports fan, so don't take this as a condemnation of sports as a whole, but we look at athletes and we glorify them for their competitiveness, for the way they refuse to lose, the way they always want to be the best. They can't stand to see other people win while they're losing. And we look at the way they always do whatever it takes for them to get to the top. And you know what? That's basically just renamed bitter jealousy and selfish ambition. Selfish ambition, that drive, nothing is going to stop me, I'm going to get to the top. So I think we need to be careful as parents, as we're raising kids and we're teaching them, we want them to play sports, we want them to compete, to work hard, and yet at the same time, we need to watch out for some of these qualities that can come out of our lives and our own hearts, and as we're raising the values that we teach our children and we put on display as we live our lives. Okay, so that's the first thing, the symptoms of this first type of wisdom. Now we'll move on to its source. Where does this wisdom come from? And we get this from verse 15. Jealousy and selfishness are not God's kind of wisdom, but such things are earthly, unspiritual, and demonic. There, when it says that these are not God's kind of wisdom, a literal translation of what's there would be like, these things do not come from God. Instead, they are earthly. Three qualities here: unspiritual and demonic. Earthly is that concept of, they're just bound by the concerns of this world, the things that are immediate to life on earth without reference to God or eternal life or anything beyond just those 70, 80, 90 years that you're going to live here. So it's characterized by a short-range perspective. It's characterized with mostly physical concepts. And James is saying that this first type of wisdom comes from that sort of source. The second thing is it's unspiritual. And this concept is kind of like the opposite of the notion of the soul. And it could be also translated like physical. It has to do with just those immediate appetites that we have, the appetites and desires that drive us, again, without reference to God, what he has for us, what his desires might be. And then finally, demonic. And it's a little bit surprising to me that James would say that this wisdom is demonic. It's not just sort of a benign thing, but it actually comes from a very evil, sinister source. But you take those three things together. The reformers a lot of times talked about how sin and temptation come from three sources. They come from the world, the flesh, and the devil. James is paralleling those concepts right here, earthly, unspiritual, physical, something like that, and demonic. So the source of this wisdom, this first type of wisdom that James is describing is certainly a sinister, bad source. And then the third question, if we just leave this, what's the prognosis if we just leave this wisdom to kind of run its course? And you look at verse 16, he describes where this wisdom is going to end up. Wherever there's jealousy and selfish ambition, there are going to be two things, disorder and every evil practice, or evil of every kind. So the first thing is just that notion of disorder, and it makes sense, right? Because if every decision you make is only made with reference to what's going to gratify your desires and your appetite, what's going to put you on top, if you're running your life based on selfish ambition, bitter jealousy, you can't really celebrate the successes of other people, then it makes sense that you're not going to get along very well with other people. That notion of disorder is the concept of relational turmoil, that as you interact with others, you're constantly just bumping into each other. You've constantly got something where you're not seeing eye to eye with somebody else. And that makes perfect sense, right, of this first type of wisdom. And then James just gives a blanket statement. He says, not only is it going to lead to disorder, but just in general, it's going to lead to all kinds of evil practices. It's just evil of every kind. So that's the first picture of wisdom that James has here, verses 14 through 16. But then he turns to this concept of true wisdom, and we're going to look at those same three qualities. Try to pick them up as we read through verses 17 and 18 again. But the wisdom from above is first of all pure. It is also peace-loving, gentle at all times, and willing to yield to others. It is full of mercy and good deeds. It shows no favoritism and is always sincere. And those who are peacemakers will plant seeds of peace and reap a harvest of righteousness. All right. So the first thing that you notice as you look at verse 17 is that this is a wisdom that comes from above. Its source is God, its heavenly source. If you remember back at the very beginning of the book of James, he says, if anyone lacks wisdom, if you need it, then ask of God, who gives generously and without finding fault. So this is that type of wisdom that James is describing, a wisdom that comes from God, it originates in him. And notice it's the polar opposite of that wisdom that's earthly and unspiritual and demonic. So that's where it comes from. And then most of verse 17 is the question of this wisdom's symptoms. What does it look like? And look at these. I just want to camp out here for a little bit and describe these different qualities. James gives seven aspects of this type of wisdom, seven symptoms of what true wisdom is going to look like. And the first thing he says is that, first of all, this wisdom is pure. So he's saying that the cardinal virtue, the biggest thing, the most defining characteristic of this wisdom is purity. And that's the concept of purity here is like the idea of moral innocence or blamelessness. It's that freedom from moral compromise, you know, and our purity is constantly being attacked by just the environment that we live in. We have our own inclinations that at times will draw us away and challenge us in this area. And, you know, I just think about all the different areas where purity can show up in our lives and what a wise person with purity, that's going to come out in so many different ways. You think about our speech, the language that we use, how we talk, but also the content of what we're talking about. What are we willing to talk about with other people? When people are joking around, do we chime in with our own jokes that we've heard that maybe aren't totally totally appropriate. You know, purity in our speech is a big thing, or our thoughts. You know, I sometimes think if you could plug in some sort of mind-reading device into my head and just have it absorb and expose all of my thoughts for the next week, I don't think the judgment that would come out on that would probably be pure. You know, that there are so many images that I entertain in my mind, so many attitudes that I have towards other people that fall short of the standard of purity. And then you think about your actions and the things that you do. You know, cutting corners to save costs at work. You know, it's easier just to compromise in so many areas than to pay the price for purity, because actually purity is one of these things that it's not something that's just going to be passive and maintained if you're just kind of living your life and going to try to go about things. It's going to have to be an active pursuit to maintain purity. It's going to have a cost to it in the workplace for sure, in your family. Purity is a precious concept, and it's a costly concept. But that's the cardinal virtue, I guess, of this first kind, this true wisdom. Second thing that James says is that this wisdom is peace-loving. We've kind of come to a place in our churches and our society at large where we think of the notion as peace as the absence of obvious tension or conflict. So we think of it mostly in negative terms, you know. It means not having anything kind of between me and somebody else. And so we kind of avoid conflict. We try not to offend other people and that sort of thing. But I think the biblical notion of peace is actually something much more positive and complete. It comes from that Hebrew concept of shalom, and it's the idea of wholeness and completeness. It's not just the absence of conflict, but it's actually the positive move towards reconciliation with other people. And James is saying here in this passage that godly wisdom, wisdom that comes from above, is peace-loving. You know, I think about the area of family life. And so much of what, at least in my extended family and kind of the whole network of people, what we do and the way we interact with each other is predicated upon the desire not to kind of ruffle any feathers and just to maintain this equilibrium and live without tension with other people. And yet we don't really express the willingness to move into active conversations, maybe dealing with some tough concepts, to talk through things, reconcile with each other, experience genuine peace in our relationships. Wisdom that comes from heaven is characterized by this peace, that it's a personal peace, but it's also a very relational concept of you are able to reconcile with other people and move things forward in a relationship. So that's number two. This third concept of being gentle at all times, it's the third symptom of godly wisdom. And this word, it's kind of, in Greek, it's just a single word. It could also be translated like being considerate. And the idea is from a position of power, or when you're in the position to make a decision that's going to affect other people, do you consider the needs and interests of people other than yourself? It's kind of that opposite of selfish ambition on this side, and you've got somebody who's considerate on this side. And so it's like being able to look at all the ways that your decisions affect the broader network of people that you interact with. I think one area where this shows up in marriage is with the thermostat. My wife and I have very different definitions of hot and cold. And I can set the thermostat in our house, you know, if it was up to me, probably be somewhere in like the 68 to 70 range in my house and in my car. But my wife, man, it's like she just wants to live in the tropics, you know, in our house. It's always going to be warm. And, you know, I could just kind of exert my authority as the husband, as a spiritual leader of the home, set things up and say, well, this is put on a sweater, honey, because we're going to chill out here in our house. But I think there's wisdom to this idea of being considerate. How is that decision going to affect my wife when I want the AC on in the car? I can survive with it being 10 degrees hotter. I'll be all right. And the relational peace that comes from that and the way that I'm able to interact with my wife far exceeds any discomfort that I have because of how the temperature in the room. So it's, you know, these are concepts that are very practical and can affect just the day-to-day living. But it's also, you know, you think about bigger decisions of life, being considerate is also an important thing. You know, if you have to decide between taking a promotion at work that may take more time in your job, and or maybe moving your family across the country for a job opportunity that may be a great thing for you, and selfishly, or at least when you just look at it from a dollars and cents perspective, and where you're going in your career, it may make all the sense in the world. But there's a wisdom to stepping back and considering how those decisions will affect other people. How's it going to affect your church family, the relationships that you've got rooted wherever you are, and obviously, how's it going to affect your wife, your children, extended family as well. Being considerate, that is godly wisdom. This next concept, being willing to yield to others, that's a fourth symptom of wisdom that comes from God. It's kind of the opposite. That last one we talked about being in a position to make a decision and kind of holding the levers of power. This one, willing to yield to others, it's the concept of submission and being in a position of weakness. And instead of going along kicking and screaming, you know when it's okay to just kind of yield and allow people to run their course. This actually isn't the ordinary word for wisdom submission in the Bible. This is the only place in the entire New Testament where this word shows up. But there's a wisdom to being able to allow people to exercise some decision-making of their own and to set the course and to go along with things, recognizing what areas are matters of preference and what areas are matters of principle. When do you need to take a stand and not compromise and maintain purity? And when are you able to go along, submit to something that maybe you don't entirely agree with for the good of others? Just moving on to these next ones, full of mercy and good fruit. Mercy is like an attitude, it's a feeling word. It's that feeling of compassion when you see the needs of other people. And it's going to yield good deeds. Number six, shows no favoritism. It's the idea of being impartial. You know that, and I think that this is just, this one's pretty obvious. There's a wisdom to listening to the voices of people that you don't agree with, or people that, you know, I have people in my life who, I get to a point with them where I don't, before they even open their mouths, I've kind of determined that I'm not really going to be listening to what they have to say. Or I really don't, I already know how I feel about them, I know what they're going to say, and I don't want to hear it. Well, that's not really a wise approach to things. There's a lot of wisdom to being able to hear what other people have to say about something, people who come from different perspectives and have different opinions than yourself. So it shows no favoritism, it's impartial, is able to listen to different voices. And then finally, it's sincere. And this is kind of the we talked about earlier, being considerate and selfish ambition were kind of juxtaposed. You also have this contrast between sincerity and bitter jealousy. A bitterly jealous person may congratulate you to your face, but inwardly they're just burning and wanting to, thinking they deserve what you receive. A sincere person is able to look forward and celebrate. They mean what they say, and they follow through on what they say they're going to do. So you put together these seven qualities. It's kind of interesting in the Greek. In the English, we lose kind of the rhythm of this verse, and we translate it, and every word starts with a different letter and that sort of thing. But in the Greek, this is meant to be poetic. It's kind of like a tongue twister. You look, and these are the words, and you can kind of see that the first several letters start with an E sound, or first several words, and then in the last several words end with an A sound and with this kratos ending. So it's kind of a poetic thing, and I think this verse was probably written in such a way that it would be easy to memorize. In English, we kind of lose some of that, but it'd still be a great verse to kind of commit to memory these seven facets of godly wisdom. And then ultimate result, you look at verse 18. He says, those who are peacemakers will plant seeds of peace and reap a harvest of righteousness. So the first, I think that you can distinguish kind of three results in this. There's those who are peacemakers, there's an inward peace, a personal kind of wholeness and completeness and stability to a person who lives out a life of godly wisdom. And that peace, in turn, they become agents of peace with others, able to move towards reconciliation and relationships, able to have a good kind of healthy interaction and communication with people. And then in turn, that leads to righteousness, just good deeds. The world is a better place on account of people who live with this godly wisdom. So as we look at this comparison, just kind of recapping where we come in the passage, you've got false wisdom, source is the world, the flesh, and the devil. Look on the other side, you've got true wisdom. It's what comes from above. It comes from God. Descriptions, the symptoms of it. False wisdom, bitterly jealous. It's selfish, ambition. True wisdom, we talked about those seven qualities. And then the result, the ultimate outcome. One leads to division and evil of every kind. The other leads to the exact opposite, peace and righteousness. So, talking about how we might be able to apply this passage, I think there are a few things we can do. First of all, just give yourself a checkup. You know, you look at these two symptom checklists, we can look at kind of like a mirror, and which one are we kind of identifying with? Are there some areas where maybe you can make an adjustment, incorporate some new kind of qualities into your decision making? The second thing is that we need to seek for wisdom from the right places. You know, this passage makes a point of contrasting wisdom that comes from earthly demonic sources, wisdom that comes from God. True wisdom is the wisdom that God gives, so we need to be praying for it, need to be in the Bible. You know, the book of Proverbs is a book of wisdom, and we need to be among God's people, interacting with fellow church members who can model wisdom to us and speak truth into our lives. And that leads into this third point of choose your associates carefully. Proverbs 13:20 says, he who walks with the wise grows wise, but a companion of fools suffers harm. I think about the context of the book of James. You guys remember that several weeks ago we talked about how James was written in about the middle of the first century from the city of Jerusalem, and James was an apostle in the Jerusalem church. And you remember that the church started in Jerusalem and everybody was together and they were sitting under the apostles' teaching. There were these defined structures of leadership. There was defined pastoral guidance. There was this community that was in place. And then the church got persecuted and they all had to scatter throughout the Mediterranean world. So, there you go. There's a map. You know, everyone kind of scatters around this whole region over there to the right. They're having to reestablish new connections, new networks of Christians, get resettled into areas with other people, and also having to establish who's going to be their leaders, who are they going to look up to, who's going to make decisions in their churches and be their role models. And I think a big part of what James is doing in this passage is telling them, if you want to know what a godly, wise person looks like, look for these sorts of qualities. You know, so often we're attracted to charismatic leaders who can speak well, who are humorous, who have just those natural talents that we easily gravitate towards in the beginning. But what we really need to be checking for are some of these deeper character qualities that exhibit godly wisdom, because in the long run, that's what leads to righteousness, it leads to peace. So, choose your associates carefully. And for discussion questions, just come up with these three things. First, what are your most trusted sources of wisdom? Maybe you have a role model that you turn to and you really get a lot of advice from that person. It'd be interesting to just hear where do you kind of find yourself seeking wisdom, and what things have you found that have really been effective? Number two, are there areas of your life where you struggle with jealousy or selfish ambition? These kind of symptoms of a wisdom that really isn't wisdom at all. I think we tend to have certain areas of our life where we're doing okay. Maybe there are some areas where you could work on that. Spend a little time with the Lord, kind of reflecting. and working through those things. And then number three, what feature of godly wisdom would you like to work on this week? Is there something, maybe it's the concept of purity and dealing with your thought life, you could use some accountability there, or maybe it's you could be more considerate of others and work on those things. So those are our questions, and yeah, let's talk amongst yourselves.